our presentation. And to introduce the speaker, we have Joe Fogg. Joe Fogg, I think, is well known to all of you by now, a member who has produced a number of speakers for us. And Joe happens to be in town for a few minutes. And thank you very much, Joe. Come on up and introduce our speaker.
Well, thank you very much, Madam President, and welcome members and guests to what's the largest group I've ever seen in this room. It's an incredible testimony to the anticipation of our speaker. This is a real privilege for me to be standing here for the first time, even though I have already brought three speakers to the club in the last few years, namely Phil Gramm, Newt Gingrich, and James Gorman of Morgan Stanley. Unfortunately, in each of these cases, I was unable to be present when they spoke. I assure you I had good excuses for not being here for those speakers, and I'm glad that they were well received, at least I'm told they were. But I'm happy to finally make an introduction myself, and even happier that I'm introducing one of America's most distinguished diplomats, Ambassador John Negroponte. As you have read in the information previously sent out, Ambassador Negroponte has had a long and distinguished career in government service. Briefly listing his postings in reverse chronological order, Ambassador Negroponte served most recently as Deputy Secretary of State from 2006 to 2008. As the nation's second highest diplomat, he oversaw all State Department activities overseas as basically the COO of the State Department. Prior to that, he was appointed by President Bush as the country's first Director of National Intelligence. He served as ambassador previous to that to Honduras, Mexico, the Philippines, the United Nations, and Iraq. In Washington, John served twice on the National Security Council staff, first as director for Vietnam and then as deputy national security advisor under President Reagan. While most of his career has been in government, he did work for McGraw-Hill in New York City from 1999 to 2001 as executive vice president, and we figured out last night our offices were in the same building during that period of time. Ambassador Negroponte has received numerous awards in recognition of his more than four decades of public service, including the State Department's Distinguished Service Medal on two separate occasions, the highest award that can be conferred by the Secretary of State. He is now working at McCarty Associates in Washington, D.C., which is a leading international security advisory firm. He is also a senior research fellow and lecturer in international relations at his alma mater, Yale, where he and I and probably a few others of you out there both graduated. Actually, to tell the truth, I just met John yesterday myself. The visit was arranged through mutual friends in the senior administration at Yale. But I can tell you, based on talking to him for the past 24 hours, that he's got a lot to say. Having been very close to the action his whole adult life, I'm sure John will share with us some interesting observations on the current international scene. I'm looking forward to hearing them. We're extremely fortunate at the Forum Club every few weeks to hear from some exceptionally interesting and knowledgeable people. But I believe we could hear from no one more uniquely qualified to provide insight on current issues of national security than our speaker today. Therefore, with thanks in advance to him for making this trip to Naples, I'm pleased to introduce my new friend, Ambassador John Negroponte.
Thank you. Very nice. Thank you, Joe. That was a really nice introduction, and I want to thank you for the invitation and thank the Forum Club for having me as a guest speaker here today. There are a couple of different areas that I want to talk about today. I gave a talk last night on some national security issues and foreign policy issues confronting the country. I definitely want to address that. I also want to talk a bit about intelligence, because reference was made to the fact that during the course of my career. One of the jobs that I had was as the first director of National Intelligence. But before going into any of that, and since we do have a number of high school students in our audience today, I do want to say that I was glad to hear, gratified to hear, that a number of you are thinking about possible careers in public service and in international affairs. This is very important. There's no narrow definition of international public service. You can be a diplomat like I was, and if you're interested in doing that, well, actually the State Department website is really quite user-friendly in terms of directing you as to how to go about taking the Foreign Service exam, which you have to do in order to qualify to become a Foreign Service officer. But international public service is much broader than that, obviously. There are many different departments of government, whether it's the intelligence community, the Defense Department, the Agency for International Development, the Foreign Commercial Service, where you promote American economic interests abroad, and so on and so forth. So there's no shortage of opportunities in the international sphere, and I commend those to the attention of the high school students, and I hope that some of you at least end up in those kinds of careers. Another avenue to international public service is through the military. I'm struck by the number of military officers who, after 4, 5, 7 years in their military career, make a shift, maybe go and get their master's or advanced degree of some kind or another somewhere, and then also join civilian public service. And I think very often our military, who've got the discipline, the rigors of serving in one of the armed forces, very often bring that very same kind of discipline and rigor to their approach to civilian governmental work. So that's my little pitch for the Foreign Service. I've worked in the government for 44 years and don't regret, I can't say I don't regret a minute of it. There's some, and the pastor referred to successes. Well, there's some failures too, and some of those hurt a little bit, but I certainly treasure my recollections of having worked in government. I wanted to start just briefly, since I was director, the first director of National Intelligence, to talk a little bit about intelligence before I go into foreign and national security policy. And what I want to say about intelligence, first of all, how the heck did I get the job? A number of people said, Negroponte, you don't know anything about intelligence. And why are you? Why did the president ask you to do this? Well, truth of the matter is, I certainly didn't aspire to the job. I was the ambassador to Iraq. I was sitting in my office in downtown Baghdad, just minding my business, when one day Andrew Card, the chief of staff of the president, called me up and said, John, how would you like to be the first director of national intelligence? And the first thing I did was, well, I said, let me call you back. And I went and I printed the law on the internet, 250 pages long, just to see how the job was defined. And then I called my wife. Of course, she wasn't very happy that I was out in Iraq anyway, so her advice was, take it, whatever you do. That's more or less how it happened. Now, kidding aside, actually, if you're a career diplomat, you got a lot of experience with intelligence. First of all, you have intelligence people working with you in your overseas postings. And I was, having been a 5-time ambassador, I got to know quite a few station chiefs and people up and down the whole range of the intelligence community. Secondly, of course, you're a consumer of intelligence in any policy job. After all, that's what intelligence is for. It's to help people make intelligent decisions. And of course, you generate a certain amount of your of intelligence yourself as a diplomat. I was a political officer for much of my career, and I spent my time reporting on situations here and there. I started my political reporting career in Vietnam from 64 to 68, where I was what they called a provincial reporter, where I covered 6 different provinces in South Vietnam, and I would go out each week, visit a particular province, collected whatever information I could get on the political, economic, military, security situations, and then I'd come back to Saigon. We didn't have internet or anything in those days. You had to come back. You had to write your reports, and then you'd send them in. If I remember correctly, at the beginning, we didn't even necessarily send them in telegraphically. We sent them in through by airmail back to Washington. So you generate a certain amount of intelligence during the course, or quite a bit of intelligence, during the course of a diplomatic career, as we all are regrettably discovering through these WikiLeaks that have taken place in the last, which is a real travesty, and we can come back to that if anybody wants to at some point. But there you see a lot of the kind of work that our State Department officials do abroad. It's most unfortunate that that material has been released, and there's been a certain number of references even today in the New York Times about the damage that that's done to some of our relationships around the world. Mike Hayden, who was my deputy when I was Director of National Intelligence and then became head of the CIA, he and I were talking about WikiLeaks, and he said, well, you know, what the WikiLeaks demonstrates about State Department reporting is that the State Department is full of serial truth-tellers. I mean, it really is. It's good stuff, actually, if you read it, but it's a pity that it came to public light well before the 25-year period that's normally allowed for before diplomatic communications are brought to public light, and then only after careful vetting and so on and so forth. Now, what is intelligence? Intelligence is the collection and analysis of information for purposes of statecraft. I say it, it's one sentence. And it's a really important point because I think a lot of people don't have a good definition of intelligence in their minds when they think of what it's about. They think of James Bond. They think of the CIA. They think of covert operations. It's the collection and analysis of information for purposes of statecraft. Now, there are different collection methods. There are human intelligence methods, I mean, broadly speaking, and there are technical methods. And the technical methods can include all kinds of INT, I-N-T, for it was short for intelligence. There's HUMINT, there's SIGINT, there's MASINT, which is a sort of the measurement and signatures intelligence. There's IMINT, imagery intelligence, and so forth. In the human area, of course, you've got clandestine intelligence collection, and that's the job of agencies like the CIA, and there's overt intelligence. That's what State Department officials do. That's what defense attachés do from the military. There's now more and more attention just being paid to open source intelligence, and which is really, you know, what it is you can gather through publicly available sources of information. And for any decision maker, that's probably about 95% to 98%. Of what you use as you go around calculating your own approach to particular decisions. I mean, it's the secret or clandestinely obtained information is only a small element in the situation. Let's spend a moment on what intelligence is not. It's not a panacea. Definitely, you can't do without intelligence if you're going to try to operate a large, modern state. But intelligence is just a tool. It helps decision makers make their decisions. It helps them narrow and define their choices. All of us who've been involved in making decisions in our lives, in whatever walk of life, public, private, whatever, non-governmental, we use intelligence of various forms to help us make smarter decisions, and that's what intelligence is. It's not some whole new world where if you only have access to those secrets, you're going to be able to figure everything out. I think there are some people who have this rather conspiratorial view of intelligence who think that there's a whole other level of reality out there, and if you only knew that, you would understand everything. Well, that's just not true. I think an important point to make. Who are the users of intelligence? Well, in government, in statecraft, of course, the key users are the president, for one, his national security team, whether it's the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of Defense, for another. And thirdly, I'd put as a category of important users of intelligence is our military and diplomatic establishments, all the way down to the lowest tactical level. The president, and when you're director of national intelligence, you focus on your number one customer. The president is, of course, the most important customer. George Bush was a very good customer. I had the good fortune to work for him for those couple of years as director of national intelligence. Briefed him every day but Saturday. He was briefed 6 days a week. He set aside from 8 to 8:30 very scrupulously and systematically every morning to get his intelligence briefing. I'd usually get up about 5:30 in the morning. I'd read the newspapers. I'd listen to the radio broadcast, and then I'd go in at 6:30 to meet the briefer who would come over, who would actually make the presentation to the president. We'd go over the entire morning's brief from 6:30 to 7:30, and then at 8 o'clock we'd go in to his office. He was a great person to brief. By the time I had this job, he'd already been president for 4 years, and so he'd had a lot of experience dealing with these different issues. We not only briefed him on his whatever had happened in the previous 24 hours every day, but also we would go into some fairly deeper discussion of maybe one or two or three selected issues each day. Sometimes we do what they call the deep dive. It'd be some, let's say, really key question, like the nuclear program of Iran, for example, and we'd bring in a couple of experts on Iran who would spend that time that day, the 30 minutes, briefing him on that particular subject, and we'd have a lot of, you knew you were well off the minute he started interrupting and engaging, because he had a sort of a dialectic style, and he'd sort of say, wait a minute, I've heard all that before, what about this, what about that, and then we'd have a really good discussion. So the president's an extremely important customer. Let me say a little bit about failures and successes, because almost by definition, when there's public discussion of intelligence, it's about failures, because you can't talk about the successes. And you certainly a very hard thing to do. So almost invariably, when intelligence gets publicity, it's about some quote-unquote failure. Now, often it's not a failure of intelligence, it's a failure of policy, but sometimes it's politically convenient to blame problem on intelligence failures. But there are, and we've had our share of intelligence failures, and I suppose the two most important categories that I can think of are, first of all, surprise, something happening that you don't expect, and I suppose the classic is Pearl Harbor, and there's a classic book written by Roberta Wolsetter on Pearl Harbor, which is really worth a read if you're interested in this subject matter, and she delves deeply into the issue of so-called missed signals. Now, we all know the old saying, which I think is absolutely true in this instance, that hindsight is 20/20 vision. And if you have any kind of catastrophic surprise and then mobilize a commission to study it, eventually, because you have the benefit of hindsight, you are going to connect the dots. But to my way of thinking, it's never entirely obvious that those dots were really connectable before the event actually happened. Actually, if you think about it for a moment as a point of view of philosophic history, it sort of means that the more you study past events, the more inevitable they seem to be. And yet, as somebody who's lived through the making of history, you realize that events just simply are not inevitable, and that they depend very, very much on the individual choices that leaders make over the course of time. So that's just a kind of an intellectual dilemma we have when we look back at so-called intelligence failures. We had a real whopper of an intelligence failure in the Bush administration, and that was what I would call the WMD fiasco, when it turned out that Saddam did not have any weapons of mass destruction. And yet that was, argued as the basis for having gone into Iraq. And that was based on a failure of tradecraft. There was a case where there was a predisposition on the part of our leaders to want to believe, or to believe, that Saddam had, and they did believe in good faith that Saddam had WMD programs, and therefore interpreted various signals that we got to confirm that preconception. But one of the serious problems we had, and this was studied and has been studied in fairly thorough detail by the commission that was run by Larry Silverman and Chuck Robb, former Senator Chuck Robb and Judge Silverman, on the WMD fiasco. We had a source called Curveball, of all things, and Curveball turned out to be fabricating the information that he was giving to us about WMD. But we, were so eager to believe him that we didn't spend enough time trying to validate what Curveball had to say. So when I became Director of National Intelligence, I focused on three things. Well, first of all, I had to set up the office. It was non-existent. But having got that started, I focused on three things: serving as the intelligence advisor to the president, working on the integration of the intelligence community. And by that, I mean the integration of information so that important information could be shared on a real-time basis throughout the community. And a lot of that involved making sure that databases were shared, that technology was sufficiently integrated so that you could move. I mean, in modern times, if you're going to be effective in your statecraft, you've got to be able to move this information horizontally, particularly intelligence information, on a real-time basis. It doesn't do you much good. The day and age of passing little pieces of paper to people at once-a-week clandestine meetings. Sure, you have to do some of that if you're collecting sensitive human intelligence somewhere. But by and large, you've got to be able to move that stuff rapidly so that the warfighter or the decision-maker or whomever can use it in a meaningful, real-time way. So I worked on that. I worked on serving as the intelligence advisor to the president. In fact, I consider that to be my principal job. And then thirdly, trying to improve and maintain the quality of analysis. Again, going back to my definition of intelligence, we tend to define intelligence by the method of collection. And of course, collection is only one part of intelligence. And really, it's the sausage that comes out of the machine that you really care about. It's the analytic product that comes from the information that you've collected that is really what's important to the decision maker. And, of course, there are many instances when, people, honest people, can really differ about what to make out of a piece or a collection of pieces of information. So analysis, to my way of thinking, was something that we really had to focus on a lot. And we worked on again, with the example of Curveball in mind, how do we avoid repetitions of that? Well, it had to do with validating your sources. It had to do with confirming your information through other sources. It had to do with alternative analysis. You get into a situation where everybody has preconceived notions that country X is doing such and so. Well, one good thing you can do, and we did that quite often, was to take a bunch of smart people and you say, look, here are these facts about country X, And most people have concluded that because of that, it's their intention to start a nuclear weapons program. Why don't you take the same set of facts and see if you can construct a plausible alternative analysis? So alternative analysis, red teaming, that kind of thing, was also a good thing to introduce in order to improve the quality. Is intelligence reform working? Well, first, and some people have asked me, well, would you have, you know, had you had your own way, would you have advocated intelligence reform? Well, I would have a question in my own mind about the wisdom of reforming intelligence as we did in the middle of a presidential election campaign year. It was 2004. We'd had the 9/11 Commission report, we had the WMD fiasco, and so there was this train just coming down the tracks, and it was really kind of hard to stop because people were demanding something. And very often what happens in Washington is that Congress kind of says, well, let's put some new boxes on a chart, and that is going to be a way of addressing the problem. So I have questions about that. But having said that, I think that our intelligence community has learned quite a few lessons from the recent experience. I think information sharing and responsiveness to things like terrorist threats has been very good. And I think that the country is probably safer today as a result. I have some issues with the amount of publicity that we give to intelligence. I was really quite shocked when I came back first to be the Director of National Intelligence, and I went to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and I must have met 30 or 40 correspondents who covered intelligence issues full time. I said, well, how can 30 or 40 of you find enough to write about? Ted Sorensen once asked me at the Council on Foreign Relations when I spoke as Director of National Intelligence. He got up, and his question was, why are you here? And I said, well, you invited me. And he said, 40 years ago, nobody from the intelligence community would have spoken on the record to the Council on Foreign Relations. Jim Schlesinger, who was director of the CIA back in the 70s, he used to go have periodic lunches with John Stennis, who used to be the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, because that in those days, Stennis had the oversight. And Schlesinger one day at lunch said, well, Senator, I think I ought to give you a little rundown on what I've been doing for the last, you know, since we saw each other several months ago. And Stennis said, oh, no, please don't do that. So, you know, I mean, there was a different attitude in those days. It didn't want to know what you didn't have to know kind of approach things. So I think there's been a little bit, we maybe have overcorrected here in terms of the amount of publicity that we focus on intelligence. The other thing is that if you do publicize it, and if the sort of natural thing is to focus on the failures, it becomes too politicized. And one of the things I've advocated in an article that I've written, is that the Director of National Intelligence and perhaps the head of the CIA be 10-year appointments, just the way we do with the head of the FBI, and try to lift that appointment in a sort of a definitive way out of the political process. I was disappointed that this administration changed their two top intelligence officials very shortly after taking office, both General Hayden, the director of the CIA, and Admiral McConnell, my successor as the Director of National Intelligence, were removed. So that'd be probably the one concrete suggestion I would have for the administration and for the Congress as to how we might depoliticize the intelligence function somewhat. I'm going to run out of time, as I always do, and I know Joe's been collecting some questions, but what I want to do before that is just touch briefly on what I think is in Barack Obama's inbox at the top of it with respect to foreign policy and national security, principally national security issues. And let me just go over them real quickly. Iraq. I think Iraq, we're really winding down our engagement there. I don't think there's any chance that, or there's very little prospect that we're going to have any forces there beyond the end of this year. I think they're going to be out of there, both because I think that's what the Iraqis want, and I don't think that there's much appetite on our side either to maintain a presence beyond that time. And I think George Bush did the president a great favor, did this president a great favor, by negotiating the status of forces agreement that laid out this timetable. We're basically carrying out the timetable that was negotiated between George Bush and Prime Minister Maliki. So then the question will be, will Iraq be able to hold up without the benefit of the presence of U.S. forces? And I think we're just going to have to wait and see. They're certainly in a lot better shape than they were when I got there in the end of June of 2004, when they had one battalion in their army. The army had dissolved, and we'd managed to reconstitute one battalion. Today they've got close to 200, and they've got the police had dissolved also back then. And now they've got several hundred thousand security forces. So they certainly have the wherewithal. And they happen to also have oil, so they can afford to do things, as distinct from Afghanistan, the next subject, which is a very poor country and which isn't even going to be able to pay the salaries of its own armed forces and police for years to come. So even if we withdraw by 2014, which is sort of the date now that is being cited as the possible sort of withdrawal deadline, I suspect that for Afghanistan to be viable, they're going to need substantial assistance from the international community for a long time to come. And, of course, the problem in Afghanistan, whatever progress is being made, and some is being made, there's the problem of Pakistan and the fact that you've got this kind of open border between the two countries, and the Pakistanis have not been as successful or forthcoming in bringing the cross-border movements of militant extremist elements from Pakistan into Afghanistan under control. And Pakistan is a very, very complicated situation. Indeed, as some of you will have noted from just the news of the last few days with the assassination of the secular governor of the Punjab province and so forth. Second issue on the president's agenda, in my view, is definitely non-proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, with particular focus on what to do about Iran and North Korea. And both are really very, very difficult situations. It's not for nothing that these issues are in his inbox. They got there because they're amongst the hardest issues, and it would take much longer than time than I have available right now to get into all the reasons why. But certainly Iran and North Korea are preoccupations, and I'm sure North Korea, both of those subjects, but North Korea first and Iran second, will be very much on the agenda of the meeting between President Obama and President Hu Jintao of China when he comes here to Washington later this month. And then lastly, I would put China itself as a very high issue in terms of the president's priorities because of the incredible evolution of China during the past 30 years, ever since the reforms of Deng Xiaoping and the dramatic breakthrough kind of growth of the Chinese economy. And there, I think the issue for Americans is really, it's a little different than the other two sets of issues that I've raised. It's because it's such a long-term issue. It's going to be with us for the rest of our lives. The high school students who are here today are going to be dealing, for sure, with the issue of China when they are in positions of senior responsibility. It's how do you think about China? Do you think of it as a zero-sum game? Do you think of it as a country with whom you have to develop a constructive relationship? My own view is that, you know, China's been weak for 200 years. And now, all of a sudden, it's sort of, coming back to a place that it might rightfully expect to occupy on the world stage. I think we need to try to shape that engagement of China with the rest of the world. My predecessor at the State Department, Bob Zoellick, coined the phrase, responsible stakeholder. And I think that that's what we want to do. We want to encourage China to work with us on the global scene to work constructively in the interest of world peace. I do not think that we should automatically treat them as an adversary, because I think to do that and to act as if we think the relationship is a zero-sum game, we run the risk of making it a self-fulfilling prophecy. So there are a few thoughts. I'd be glad to try and answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Enormously interesting presentation. We're very grateful to you. A couple of books to remember us by.
Thank you.
And now it's time for questions and answers, and Joe Fogg will handle that.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, that was great, and he's made my job extremely difficult, because just as I was getting this organized, he'd cover the topic. So I've had to shuffle this deck a few times here, but I think I've got some here. Believe it or not, the one topic that received by far the most questions was WikiLeaks in various forms. Now, what is the real damage? So maybe if you just expand on what you think the implications of that is.
Well, I don't think we know. I've got a mic on. I'm good. We won't know for a while. We'll have to do a thorough damage assessment at some point. I think what you're seeing happening now is sort of a piecemeal damage assessment as information becomes available. Like, for example, today in the papers, they talked about some of the human rights advocates in different countries with whom our embassies maintain relationships, as they well should. Where reporting has revealed, might have revealed their names, and which would put them in a risky position vis-a-vis the governments of the countries in which they live. So that's a serious damage. It's just too hard to tell at the moment. But let me just say this about diplomatic reporting. Diplomatic reporting is very much a sort of a baseline of information that our government uses for analyzing what goes on in the world. I mean, I come back to my point about 95% to 98% of our information being either open source or collected in an overt manner. The secret intelligence, the clandestine intelligence, is a small fraction of the inputs we use in our own minds to come to judgments about what to do about particular situations. So in that sense, I think it's very harmful that this information has been leaked. Secondly, besides the problem of relationships with various groups, like some of these human rights groups, obviously one of the serious problems is the complications and potential damage that these leaks cause in terms of our own relationships, our diplomats' relationships, with the foreign government leaders with whom they deal. I mean, if you're the king of a certain country or the prime minister or the president, and you see all of your conversations all of a sudden being leaked to the press, you might think twice about the next time the American ambassador calls up and asks for an appointment for a delegation coming into town. You might say that it's not going to definitively disrupt the relationship, but the sovereign might say, or the leader might say, well, instead of receiving this group, why don't you, have them meet my deputy foreign minister or something like that. You might lose important access, at least temporarily, because of something like this.
Okay, next is a very good question, in my opinion, from one of our students. What is your opinion on how successful the United Nations has been in the last few years, specifically with regard to responding to international crises?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I was ambassador to the United Nations for 3 years and enjoyed that experience very, very much. And it's sort of where I link my experience playing poker at Yale with diplomacy, because I've always felt that negotiating Security Council resolutions and sizing up the permanent representatives of the other major players was not that different from what I remembered some 40 or 50 years earlier in these college clubs and so forth. It was a very, very interesting thing to do. The UN gets a bum rap in this country. It's not been as effective as we would like, but I think it is undervalued in the following sense. Security Council resolutions are binding on all member states. I'm not talking about General Assembly resolutions now, which don't have any particular force to them, but a Security Council resolution has legal implications and can bind us to certain courses of action. So that's what makes Security Council resolutions so important. And there are a number of instances where the Security Council has played a major role in restoring peace to particular situations. I'd say probably in recent times the best example would be the various peacekeeping missions in Africa. Sierra Leone was a basket case when I got to the UN in 2001. The UN Security Council decided to send some 17,000 peacekeepers to Sierra Leone. The government now has a writ throughout the country, whereas it was confined to a very small space in the country's capital at the time before these troops were sent. Liberia is another example where the Security Council dispatched peacekeeping forces who've also played a very constructive role. So I think Americans sometimes just aren't really prepared to give the UN enough of a chance. And this isn't only Republicans. I think it's just generally there's a tendency on our part to want to do something ourselves. If they won't do it, or if they won't do it the way we like it, we'll do it ourselves. The trouble is, if you decide to send a peacekeeping mission through the UN, you pay 26 cents on the dollar. That's our assessment. Whereas in the other instance, if we decide to do it ourselves, we're sending our own troops, putting them at much greater risk, and paying a lot more money, because U.S. forces cost a lot more, frankly, to deploy and maintain than UN peacekeepers. So sometimes I think we make perfect the enemy of the good, and we do that at our end. I think at some damage to our own interests.
All right, here's a more personal question. What do you consider your most important diplomatic achievement?
Well, two areas that we haven't talked about at all. I worked 5 years total in the Bureau of Oceans, Environment, and Science in the State Department, and during my tenure as the Assistant Secretary in that Bureau, we negotiated the Montreal Protocol for the protection of the stratospheric ozone layer, and it is the only effective multilateral agreement on the containment of greenhouse gases that has been negotiated to this date. We successfully negotiated that in 1987. And the other thing I'm particularly proud of is that I was ambassador to Mexico from the conception to the conclusion of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which I think has been a very successful agreement, beneficial to ourselves and to our two very important neighbors, Canada and Mexico.
All right, here's an easy one, a softball.
Well, these other ones haven't been too tough.
Are we ever going to deal successfully with Islamic radicalism?
Well, I think what I would say in that question, the part that gives me a problem, is the we. I mean, who do you mean? I think this has to be dealt with in the countries where this problem occurs. And I think it's the question of governance, it's the question of responsiveness in the various societies whose conditions have given rise to this phenomenon. So I think yes, but I don't think it's our job alone. And I think if you stick with that pronoun, you run the risk of thinking that there are things you can do which you perhaps realistically cannot.
Okay. Going forward, what should be the top three intelligence priorities for the United States?
Wow. Well, I mean, I don't know how you can slice that in a lot of different ways. I think keep the focus on improving analysis, I think, is one. You don't want to have another one of these fiascos. I think keep building our human intelligence capabilities, which were allowed to atrophy somewhat in the 1990s. You remember the peace dividend? And a lot of national security workers were laid off in the 90s. And then that capability had to be rebuilt after 9/11, and that's why you read often about the large number of contractors we use, because you couldn't meet that urgent need without hiring retirees as contractors to do a lot of this kind of work. So I think you have to keep working on building these capabilities, and I think those would be 2 points that I would mention.
Okay. You talked a bit about China, didn't really talk about Russia, but this is kind of looking at it with a little bit differently. How are those two countries, Russia and China, focusing their intelligence assets today?
I think you better go to the next question.
You can't say that. Okay. You can't answer that on public information. You have too much of the
I
other.
Think it'd be dangerous to start. Other. Now you know why very often we say you won't comment on intelligence matters.
All right. I guess there were several people who asked about Iran. You talked about
right.
that. But what do you see as the end of that situation? Where are we going to end
Very
up?
Difficult. Yeah, here we are, 32 years after the Iranian Revolution, and it sort of still looks about like it did then in terms of the radical nature of the regime and its kind of hostile, unfriendly intent towards its neighborhood. I mean, everywhere you look in the Middle East, there are problems caused by Iran, whether it's supporting militant Shia groups in Iraq with explosively formed projectiles that were killing American and Iraqi troops, disruption in Lebanon, radicalization of the Palestinians. They've not played a constructive role. So I don't know how, and of course we have the issue of the fact that they have been enriching uranium and developing this nuclear capability. They certainly have worked hard on the delivery capability and developing a weapon and on having the necessary fuel. And the estimate is that sometime between now and 2015, they are actually going to have a weapon. So rather than answering your question as to how we deal with it, which is very hard, I mean, there's a limit to the number of ways you can go about this. You can try to destroy their capability, which is not a choice that people like to put on the table, although our presidents usually don't remove it entirely from the table either. There's economic sanctions, but there are those who would say that they're just not tough enough to hurt Iran in sufficient way to cause them to change their behavior. And the third thing, of course, is to encourage some kind of regime change in that country. But this is going to be a big issue. I think this one's going to be in the inbox for the remainder of the term, if I dare say.
Okay. This is the last question, in some ways my favorite. Do you read the novels of David Baldacci or Vince Flynn? And if so, is the stories portrayed there anything close to reality?
Yeah. You know, this is very this is going to disappoint you. I'm such a bore that I spent my life reading all those telegrams that you've now seen leaked in the Wikipedia, and then I read intelligence reports, and I read newspapers, and I tend to focus on nonfiction. Now, maybe it would, improve my own perspective on things to read fiction, but I really haven't done that.
Well, I'll give you a
I'm
few.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
I'll give you a few this afternoon.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
We're running a little bit behind schedule, but we had a late start, I think, due to the size of the audience today. Thank you all for coming. We could have sat here all afternoon, I think, hearing more from the ambassador. We'll see each other in another 3 weeks or so. Thank you.